cancer treatment, head injuries, and the headache caused by Florida's recount. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Haiti has few options for people who have cancer. The government has spent little for treatment and prevention. We're going to look at a new investigative series from the Miami Herald about healthcare in Haiti. Also, the recount in the 2018 Florida midterm is supposed to end today at 3 o'clock. Will any race get flipped? One might. We're going to hear from the Democratic campaign for Agriculture Commissioner. And over the past decade, the issue of concussions and brain trauma is starting to raise questions about safety in football.
You worry about your kid playing football or crossing the street. We just hope that they're safe and they have a good time.
We're going to hear from Diana Brett, a South Florida mother whose son Daniel suffered from multiple head injuries in his years playing youth football. He eventually took his own life. What are the signs concussions are hurting your child? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Haiti has one of the highest rates of cervical cancer in the country of more than 11 million people. There is no proper treatment for many cancer diseases. There's no access, for example, to radiotherapy. By the time a woman in Haiti realizes she has cervical cancer, it's often too late. The closest point of access to treatment is the Dominican Republic, and the cost is high. Jacqueline Charles has been covering Haiti for the last 12 years for the Miami Herald. For the past 7 months, she's been working on a project about cancer treatment in Haiti, a disease that today, for many Haitians, primarily poor Haitians, appears to be an epidemic. She joins us to share her reporting and explain the problems of Haiti's public health care system. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Why is it so challenging to find treatment for any kind of cancer in Haiti?
First of all, there are only really three places in Haiti that provide chemotherapy, and one of them is the general hospital. And if you go to the general hospital, like I did, what you find is there are no recliners, there are just three beds, and there is no chemotherapy. You have to buy the chemo yourself. So if I have to buy the chemo myself, why am I going to the public hospital? So your next option is to go to Mille Ballet, which is a hospital that was founded after, it was built after the earthquake, $16 million, state-of-the-art facility. It will rival any hospital in the U.S. But when you go there, what you find is that people have been sleeping there for days in the yard just so they can be the first in line. And it offers free care. But over the years, donors, whether it's Haiti fatigue or other priorities, they're not providing the type of assistance that they did. So it's a struggle. So something as basic as Ensure, which is to provide nutrients to people who are on chemotherapy because they have to remain healthy. The hospital used to be able to provide that for free. It can't. My person that I spoke to, Paula Paul, when I arrived to see her in Haiti, we had been chatting for several months. But when I arrived, she said to me, I'm not going to go get my chemo. I said, why? She says, because I don't have the money. Well, how much is the money for transportation from your house to the hospital? It was the equivalent of almost $3.50. $3.50. And this woman honestly did not have that bus fare.
To get to the treatment. You looked at cervical cancer rates in Haiti. You reported that cervical cancer is almost always a death sentence in the country. How much of it is the healthcare system, as you've been describing, the cost? How much of it has to do with beliefs in medicine?
How much does it have to do with just a lack of political will? You know, the primary treatment for cervical cancer is radiation. During the dictatorship, Haiti had radiation. Today, radiation, radiotherapy, it does not exist. So if you need radiotherapy for your cancer, you have to go to the Dominican Republic or Cuba, and you're looking at anywhere between $10,000 and $15,000 US. So there was a plan to build a radiotherapy center. It was a line item. There were people who were trained, who have been trained. Many of them are still in the country. And then the earthquake happened, and somewhere this no longer became a priority. I went to go look for the first stone that was laid for that radiotherapy center, and nobody could tell me. I had to find a guy in the yard of the hospital, the current general hospital, who remembered when they had that ceremony, you know, less than 10 years ago. So today you don't even have a real registry to tell you how many people are dying of cervical cancer, much less cancer in general. So it raises the question in terms of political will.
And if it's hard to even pin down that number, then I'm curious as to when and how are women finding out that they have it?
Women are finding out very late. And what's going on is that they either have been spotting and they just assume that it was their birth control oftentimes. Sometimes they do go and they will get a pap, but it will give a false negative for a host of reasons. But by the time a woman discovers that the reason why she was spotting and having this pain, she is so far advanced in her cervical cancer that surgery alone will not help. And she needs radiation. And because there's no radiation, and because she often doesn't have the money to travel to the Dominican Republic or Cuba or even the United States, she has no other option but to go on palliative care, which is basically comfort care. We're going to help relieve some of this pain while you die.
Is there any effort right now by the government to deal with this issue, to bring radiotherapy, thinking about women today, but also the future, you know, young women, you know, looking forward?
Well, as I talk about in the main story today, you know, there are efforts, you know, discussions about HPV, the HPV vaccine, where you can save a whole generation of young girls from this disease that is preventable and that is treatable. When I spoke to Gavi, which is the International Vaccine Alliance, they said to me, we're not going to give Haiti access, you know, to this vaccine, because they're not doing the job they're supposed to do with childhood vaccination. So before we help introduce a new vaccine, we want to see them do what they need to do with helping keep children alive between the ages of 1 and 5. But at the same time, there are some NGOs that they have done pilot programs. They've provided the vaccine to over 25,000 girls, and those girls today are safe. They will not get cervical cancer, at least not from HPV. There's also, you know, efforts, just individual efforts in terms of the NGOs to increase screening among women. There's a story later today that we'll publish. It talks about the factories, getting women in the workplace where they work, getting them to screen and talking to them so that they understand that they can be proactive about this disease. And then there's, you know, there is a National Cancer Registry. I mean, the guy who's in charge is a former minister of health, and he's been at it. And what's interesting with him is 3 times a year he has to get into a beat up Nissan Patrol, and he showed us the car, and he has to travel this entire country to go and collect documentation of cancer cases, because when he asks the regional ministers of health to do this, they refuse to turn this information over because they don't see the importance of it. So I'm sitting in his office and I see a board and I said, well, what's that one cancer case? You're telling me in the northwest region of the country there was only one cancer case? He says, no, they only turned that one sheet of paper in.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Haiti correspondent, Jacqueline Charles. She traveled back and forth from Haiti to Miami for 7 months reporting on this investigative cancer series. Charles has been covering Haiti for the last 12 years, by the way, for the Miami Herald. Talking about, and not just cervical cancer, but there was a powerful series that, or story, I should say, you had on these two teenage boys in Haiti with advanced forms of cancer. And one of them is receiving treatment in Miami. The other struggling to get treatment in Haiti. How did you find them?
You know, it's quite interesting. The first young boy, Jean-Sly Alcin, who's 14 years old, and he's currently being treated by Baptist Health. I found him because I was just having a random meeting with an individual, actually Calvin Batcock, who happened to have been the chairman of Baptist, but I had no idea that he was the chairman of Baptist Hospital. But we were talking about his charity and the work that he was doing in Haiti. And I mentioned to him that I was working on this story, and I had spent some time at the pediatric hospital in Haiti that has only 10 hospitalized beds for the entire country. And by the way, you know, 15% of the 35% actually of the population of Haiti is under the age of 15. So imagine 10 hospitalized beds, that's it. And so I was saying, you know, I'm really trying to find, you know, two kids, whether boy, girl, but, you know, that's undergoing, you know, treatment or struggling to find treatment for cancer. And then he mentioned the story about this young boy who, through a stroke of luck, ended up here in Miami after his mother for almost 2 years could not find a diagnosis for why his eye was bulging out of the socket and why he eventually had lost sight in that eye. And so at the same time, I was talking to another person in Haiti who, interesting enough, Calvin knew, put me in touch with this guy, and he had a kid, and that kid had a huge tumor on his face. But they were waiting for the biopsy to come back, and we weren't sure if it was cancerous or not. And so there's a doctor, a plastic surgeon, Dr. Mixter, who's from Wisconsin, and he was involved in this case. And then it turned out that the biopsy, you know, was negative for cancer. And then Mixter says, but you know, I've got this other kid in Haiti, and he's got Burkitt's lymphoma. And I've been trying to get him into the children's hospital, but he's too old because they stop at 14. So I asked if he can put me in touch with the kid, and he was a little reluctant, you know, doctor-patient confidentiality. But eventually he gave me the number. I cold called the kid, and he called me on my last day in Haiti, and I went to see him. And that's where, you know, the conversation started.
And, you know, we have this this cut in your story. This is from a nurse from Baptist Hospital in Miami that you interviewed, and she was talking about these two boys.
Jocelyn has a greater chance of survival, even with a cancer that advanced. On the other hand, Julie in Haiti, which is cancer is not as advanced, even he has it for a long time, but while Julie can have access only to minimal, only the little chemo that he can receive at Mir Ballet. And then, you know, the back and forth to Mir Ballet is like hours on the public bus. And then the food, sometimes they cannot afford to buy the proper nutrient for patients who are on chemo they're supposed to eat. With Julie, sometimes they have to wait, I think, almost a month to give him chemo because he was so sick, he was so anemic, because he wasn't drinking. That boy was like skin and bone.
So one has a far more advanced situation, but has a better chance because they're here in Miami. How are they doing right now?
Well, Jean-Slee, who's here today, he's actually getting his chemo treatment, and he has stage 4 optic glioma, which is a cancer that started in the nerve of the eye. And by the time he came here, it had already spread down his spine. He was on one regimen of chemo, which was not working, and now they're trying another regimen of chemo with him. So, and they're being very cautious with his prognosis. But the other kid, Julie, he ended his 6 cycles of chemo on October 8th, and a month after that, he sent me a photo, and the photo basically showed that the tumor had come back. And his doctors at Mir Ballet had made it very clear to me that if the chemo does not work, there's nothing else that they could do, even though they know that there are other chemo mixtures that are out there that exist, but they just don't have access to it in Haiti. And 2 days ago, he texted, and he was in a lot of pain, and he's not sleeping. There is one Dr. Mixter, in fact, is trying to see if there's a hospital in South Florida that would be willing to, you know, to treat this young man. But right now, it's not looking good for him at all.
Real briefly, comes back to this question of political will. And I'm just wondering, you know, do you get the sense at all that there's going to be any political will to try to improve treatment in any way, just to add something? Or are we going to have to depend on philanthropists, healthcare folks here in the United States or other countries?
No, that's not sustainable. I mean, the reality is that Haiti needs to address its public health crisis because it's not just cancer. I mean, kids are dying of basic childhood diseases, you know, malaria, diarrhea, tuberculosis. These are still huge problems. You know, I got beat up on Twitter a couple of days ago because I highlighted the fact that the president of the Senate was basically bragging about the fact that he went to the Dominican Republic earlier this year to go get his physical. And I said, well, what is the message that a law maker sends to Julie, Jocelyne, their mothers, or Paula, or Gerda, when he crosses the border for health care and they don't have that opportunity or that choice? They are basically left with what's there, and oftentimes the only thing that's left for them is the philanthropic efforts like Innovating Health International or, you know, Partners in Health, Mir Ballet. So Haiti has to really start to say, where do we go from here, and how do we fix our healthcare system, because it needs fixing?
Again, Jacqueline Charles covers Haiti and the Caribbean for the Miami Herald. Powerful series, again, looking at cancer in Haiti. And we'll have links, by the way, on our website. Please check it out. Again, powerful stories, though. Difficult to read, but also something really important to read. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, the Florida recount supposed to end today. One race may get flipped. We're going to talk with a member of the Nikki Fried campaign. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, at 3 o'clock today, the recounts for three Florida statewide races should be finished. As of this morning, Broward County finished its recount ahead of schedule. Numerous counties are still completing theirs, including Palm Beach County. Palm Beach faced a major setback on Monday as nearly 200,000 early votes needed to be recounted because of machine error. Now, one of the close races being monitored is that for Agriculture Commissioner. As of Saturday, Democrat Nikki Fried declared victory with a slim 5,000-vote margin. Now, because that race was within a quarter of a percent differential, a hand recount was required. We spoke with Republican Matt Caldwell on Tuesday, and you can hear that interview on our website, WLRN.org. Now, Caldwell has filed a lawsuit against the Broward County Supervisor of Elections for failing to produce documents that show all votes were received prior to the 7 p.m. deadline on Tuesday. We're joined now by former Congressman Patrick Murphy, who's leading the transition team for the Fried campaign. Mrs. Fried was unavailable to join us for this conversation. Mr. Murphy, it's a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We know Broward County finished tabulating its vote recount ahead of the deadline today, which is 3 o'clock. What do we know about what's going on in Palm Beach County? What are you hearing?
Well, your guess is probably as good as mine when it comes to Palm Beach and Broward and South Florida. We always seem to have these issues. But I'm, of course, hopeful that Palm Beach will get this wrapped up by that 3 o'clock deadline. We know there have been, you know, numerous lawsuits and numerous, you know, cases coming down. Just last night, there was a case, for example, allowing folks with signature mismatches to come in get that cured and or email that affidavit with the signed, you know, signature.
Didn't you have it?
I happen to be one of those people, right? So okay. I'm in the process of getting that affidavit filled out, getting a picture of my license, and going to email that in, you know, today or tomorrow. It's due Saturday. I think at noon is the deadline. So you can email or go in person to Supervisor of Elections if you've had a signature problem.
Tell me what happened with you. What was the issue with yours?
Yeah, you know, So I voted by mail in the primary, right? Same signature I've used since I was 15. Didn't have a problem voting in the primary like that. And after, you know, this close election, logged into the Palm Beach County Supervisor of Election website on Thursday morning, really in large part because there were so many close elections and speculation that maybe votes didn't count and there were signature problems. So I said, you know, let's just double check and make sure I wasn't one of those. Well, lo and behold, screenshot comes up and says invalid signature, click here for the resolution. Well, you click there for that form and it turns out it was due Monday the 5th. It was due, you know,
the day before.
Right, the day before the election. We're thinking to yourself, if you voted by mail and followed the law and it got there by 7 p.m. on election day, and now there turns out to be a problem with that signature, there's nothing you can do. So in the judge's ruling last night, he said that, you know, basically doesn't make sense. Folks deserve to be able to do this after the election and deserve a day or two to be able to get that fixed. So that's this current ruling that came down to let the thousands of folks out there with these problems fix it.
And you would only have known if you had checked.
Right.
They weren't going to call you.
No, they weren't, which is, you know, the other sort of obvious fix to me in this day and age that the supervisor election isn't being proactive in this, right? I mean, I'm sure you and so many of our listeners got dozens of text messages reminding us to vote and telling us about certain campaign issues via text or email. Well, why can't the supervisor election do that and say, hey, Mr. Mrs. XYZ, we have a problem with your, you know, signature. Please come in by Thursday at noon with your ID and we'll resolve this.
One of the big questions that obviously will be discussed after this election is over. Coming back to Nikki Fried's campaign, announces the victory. Is there any danger in announcing it before this is all said and done?
No, it's look, she won the election, right? I mean, she's up thousands of votes. It's exactly the right thing to do. And it's the exact thing that, Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott have done. And, you know, I'll tell you from my experience, in my first election in 2012, we were up about 2,000 votes against Alan West in that election at, you know, 2 a.m. or whatever it was. And we're up those amount of votes, we declared victory, right? And as the days and weeks went on, they continued to do the retabulations.
But Andrew Gillum's campaign, Senator Nelson's campaign, they've all said, wait, it's just too early, wait.
Right, well, it always depends on what side of the coin you're on, of course. But look, if you're Nikki Fried, if you're an individual who has got the most votes on election night or that, you know, early that next morning, you move on as is. You know, it's really not about you or your opponent in that case. It really becomes about the voters. And that's the way I approach it. And that's the way we're approaching it right now in the, you know, Nikki Fried transition is, hey, we don't have days and weeks to waste with these recounts and lawsuits. We've got to be ready come January 8th to handle this transition, right? There are so many important priorities that we've got to get done for the voters and dozens and dozens of positions to be filled.
So your opponent, Matt Caldwell, again, filed the lawsuit against Brenda Snipes, claiming she cannot verify when all of the early voting, absentee voting, and provisional ballots were submitted. Her first hearing is with Mr. Caldwell tomorrow. Do you see legitimacy in Mr. Caldwell's suit to gather this information?
You know, honestly, I haven't read it, nor am I an attorney, so probably out of my purview to even comment on that.
You know what? I wondered if your campaign has had the opportunity to speak with the election supervisor in Broward or Palm Beach County, because I know that you just said a moment ago you're trying to get in the loop and figure out, but where is the information coming from? Where are you getting it from? How are you learning about what's going on?
So I don't want to speak on behalf of the campaign because I don't know if they've spoken directly to them.
Okay.
Me as an individual, just Patrick Murphy, the voter, saw a early morning article about this particular case that applied to me with my signature issue. Got on the phone immediately and went through the normal steps of calling the supervisor of elections to get the information that I actually didn't have to go in person. I could do it by email. So it's just a matter of picking up the phone. You know, you got to wait, you know, a few minutes to get through. But on the campaign front, I'm not sure if they've been in touch.
So let's do this. As Patrick Murphy, tell me what are your thoughts on everything that's happened? I mean, look, three races were really tight.
Right.
And the rule is, it automatically triggers the recount. But now, of course, you've got all of these questions about what's happening in Broward and, of course, now what's happening in Palm Beach County. Your take on everything that's happened.
So the rule itself of, you know, being under the 0.5% threshold makes sense to me, right? That I think gives voters some more confidence in the electoral process. If it's at that close of election, let's have a recount. Very rarely do they get overturned statistically. But that's fine with me. But the actual process in order to get there, and these lawsuits and these retabulations and recounts and machine errors and machines breaking down and overheating is an embarrassment, right? It's an embarrassment to the counties that are having the problems, to the state, to the country. And it's not just South Florida, right? And let's not forget in Bay County, despite the governor's specific email, right, to supervisor
in the
election
panhandle
leader,
of Florida.
In the panhandle, right, saying do not count elections that come in by email, they still did it. So we've got to have accountability. In my, you know, sort of perfect world, and I hope this is something that, you know, Governor-elect DeSantis looks at, is making sure that there's some sort of uniform, you know, policy, right? That we are having the, you know, basically the same machines, the same policies, the same deadlines. And let's move beyond signatures. In this day and age, in 2018, the fact that we're talking about volunteers, not trained experts, and signatures seems a little silly to me. And, you know, God bless the volunteers for what they do, but we have blockchain technology. We've got all sorts of other technologies with biometrics that we can be using that are very inexpensive and will give, I think, more confidence to the voters in our elections.
And I want to mention, too, that Senator Nelson has sued to try to stop those votes up in Bay County because there were a number of them that were sent in by email and by fax,
right,
to not count those. Again, talking with Patrick Murphy, he's a former Florida congressman, now part of the Nikki Fried transition team into her position as agriculture commissioner. Again, the recount's still going, but she did claim victory. She now has a lead over 5,000 votes. The race for Florida's agriculture commissioner, one of the three statewide races that was really tight in this midterm, and it triggered the recount. Counties were expected to finish that recount again today by 3 o'clock, and we're going to keep you up to date on that. So, you know what? What's your take on the politicizing of elections, the elections process here in Florida? Because, again, you have, going back to one of the lawsuits by Governor Rick Scott, a judge said, everybody, slow down. Stop with the comments. We can't be calling fraud. Let's just slow it down. Let the process happen. Let's see where it goes from there. But what do you think about how it's become so political?
Yeah, you know, I hate to sound partisan right now, but this is starting at the top, right? This is starting with President Trump and dating back to his election in 2016, alleging voter fraud, alleging just this week that people are changing clothes, putting new hats on, you know, coming in to vote twice or
These
three
are
times.
Comments he made recently about, you know, saying that people were
right.
going and changing their clothes, coming back in and voting again.
Right. Literally making things up out of thin air, right? He's got this like guy, he always quotes, I talked to a guy who heard this is happening. It's like this mystery person that doesn't exist, living in some sort of dream world. And it's beyond that, though. It's not for a good reason that this is happening. It's not for a good reason that Rick Scott is continuing to fan the flames of fraud. It suits their purpose because they are going after a base of people that believe in these government conspiracies, that believe that it is, you know, that they are sort of this underdog and fanning those flames for conspiracy.
Going after this group of people that we saw more turnout for this midterm than in 2014. So do you think that things like this could hurt people's trust in the system? Or
Absolutely.
Do you think it's just that group of people who don't want to believe in the system?
Absolutely. This doesn't stop with a small group of people. This will, uncertainty, these question marks that get out there, maybe don't take effect overnight with people, but one example after another, and you start seeing more and more examples of questions happening, people are naturally going to start to call into question the electoral process.
That only benefits
people like Donald Trump.
What do you think happens by 2020?
You know, unfortunately, I'm usually an optimist, but in this case, I'm somewhat pessimistic because I think they are very intentionally laying the groundwork for questions about the next election, right? The next big election, the presidential election. And by laying this groundwork now, starting to ingrain that in people's mind, if there is a dispute or a close election, that gives them the authority to say, no, it didn't count. I won. And you know, it's my word versus yours. And I'm the president, and calls into this real constitutional crisis.
If everything stays the same, nothing changes, then Mrs. Fried maintains her victory. She's going to be in a predominantly Republican cabinet and deal with a Republican legislature and a Republican governor. What are the plans on how to push her policy ideas when you're probably going to face a lot of opposition?
You know, Commissioner-elect Fried is common sense, right? She's not a politician. She wants to get things done. That was the campaign she ran on was, hey, I'm going to go there to Tallahassee to solve problems and bring everybody's concerns to the table. I am hopeful that that is received with an open door by the rest of the cabinet and the governor and lieutenant governor to actually get things done and not turn this into some sort of partisan game. And with a lot of the issues that, you know, she is most passionate about, like protecting our waterways, like making sure the implementation and rollout of medical marijuana is done correctly, by making sure that we have a safe community to live in, by making sure that, say, you know, concealed weapons permits, for example, don't have this flaw that we saw under, you know, Adam Putnam's, you know, regime that was there where they weren't even looking at the background check. So she's going to make sure that these, to me, all common sense, and I think most voters' common sense policies are implemented. And that's exactly why she won this election.
Just real quickly, if I can, in 30 seconds, if after the 2000 election, there had to be a lot of things changed with voting in Florida after this election. Do you see anything that has to change?
Yes. The first thing I'd point to is the resolution to move that date back 2-3 days if you have a signature problem, to make sure and hope that the supervisor election will proactively tell voters, hey, there's a problem for whatever reason with your ballot. Proactively tell them, hey, you have 2 days to get in here and fix that. But let's get these machines right. We shouldn't be having machines break down. We should make sure that sort of obvious things are fixed.
Patrick Murphy, former Florida congressman, now leading Nikki Fried's transition team into her position as agriculture commissioner. Again, we're waiting for those recount numbers. The figures come in. The deadline, 3 o'clock today. Mr. Murphy, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, we love football. We know there's a risk to the game. Two powerful interviews ahead on the dangers of concussions to the game and to our children. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, for years, the violence of football was one of the attractions to the game. Look, I'll admit it, I loved watching these giant, powerful athletes smash into each other. But eventually, we've learned that all of that head smashing is causing serious damage to the brains of these athletes. The word concussion has become part of the fans' vernacular, and so has the word CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Now, one of the authors speaking at the Miami Book Fair this Saturday is Mark Leibovich, who will discuss many aspects of the NFL in his new book titled Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Now, we talked recently about how the league and the owners are treating the issue of concussions and if they're afraid that this is going to hurt the bottom line.
I think it's existential issue one for the game. I mean, if you look at any number of factors, whether it's how parents sort of treat the game and whether they let their kids play, and you've seen across the board drops in participation levels, which will affect the game long term. It'll affect the kinds of populations and the kind of people who play it 20, 30 years from now. And you sort of wonder, has this sport peaked? And because of cultural changes and awareness about new scientific discoveries and new medical discoveries, the question is, I mean, could football, you know, go the way of boxing? Could it go the way of smoking? I mean, something that people have universally sort of decided is unsafe for a lot of reasons and really make a dent in what we've become accustomed to.
And you even brought up in the book the movie Concussion. This is the one with Will Smith, based loosely on the real doctor who discovered the CTEs in yeah. former players. And right. you showed how the NFL at one point they hired PR people for this. They did focus groups. They wanted to know how to deal with this movie before it came out. I mean, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what was their concern with it?
Their concern was that it was going to, like, turn people off to football, that it was going to be yet another sort of cultural wedge that will sort of run against football. It will make people think less and less, you know, more ambivalently about the game, that they want to market as an escape. The NFL has always wanted to market football as something you could just go to and put your problems away, not think about health and safety, not think about politics. And this was a classic movie about how you just can't do that. There's a real human toll here, there's a real medical toll here, and it really ruins lives. Now, having said that, the movie didn't do so well at the box office. It was critically acclaimed. A lot of people around the league certainly talked about it, but it didn't make that much of an impact. So, like companies that are afraid of, you know, of having their golden goose killed, whether it's the tobacco companies or any kind of, you know, industrial company that, you know, fears, you know, some kind of pollution regulation, the NFL tried to soft pedal this as much as possible. And they had their talking points and they had their message and they had their ad campaigns. And the result, I mean, I don't know how much of it is cause effect, how much of it is the NFL killed this movie, but for whatever reason, the NFL just kept humming right along, and Concussion, you know, was not exactly a box office smash the way the Super Bowl is.
How many players did you talk to over the time that you spent working on this book, who players who are older mm-hmm. and who are struggling right now with cognitive issues, headaches, and memory loss and everything else?
Several dozen. I mean, I think pretty much every former player I talked to over the age of maybe, say, 55 has had real problems, and many of them quite younger. I mean, one of the more striking experiences for me, and I detailed this all in Big Game, is just going to the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies every year in Canton, Ohio, and getting to see these great football players in their gold jackets, the Hall of Famers, up close. And it's this place that is an incredible nostalgia glory machine. It's like you celebrate the game, and yet you just cannot help but have these experiences and seeing these players in just really, really rough shape.
Yeah, I think about, too, when we talk about some of these old-time players, I mean, here in Miami, we have the famous 1972 Miami Dolphins team. And, yes. you know, some of those players, two players have died, Bill Stanfill and Earl Morrill. Stanfill had Parkinson's and dementia. Morrill, they found his brain did have serious signs of brain trauma. Now you have some of the players that are still alive, like Nick Bonacani, really a big hero yeah. down here, who's struggling. I think he's also said things at the Hall of Fame that the league is kind of scared of hearing.
I think the league would rather not hear from Nick Bonacani. I mean, Nick Bonacani is, I mean, obviously one of the most visible and certainly legendary players on that team. He's had his own physical toll, and his son was paralyzed. And, you know, he himself has been a real activist for spinal cord injury. And look, his whole family has been impacted for better, and it would seem like more so for worse, by football. And yeah, no, I mean, I think the league, like any sort of corporation, wants this to be as clean and as comfortable an operation as possible. And that includes you know, hoping that the people who have less good stories to tell, who have harrowing stories to tell, don't say anything. But look, these are human beings who I'm thankful that they're telling their stories, and we, because of that, get a greater awareness of what the game means and what it brings.
I'm talking with New York Times writer Mark Leibovich. His new book, Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times, is one of the titles at the Miami Book Fair this year, and we're discussing the ongoing health concerns in the sport as new research is uncovered about the long-term damage done to players. A lot of what he talks about as well in the book. He covers many things in this book, but I wanted to focus on the health issues. There was a point in the book, you were watching the Super Bowl, you were watching your New England Patriots, and you were one of your favorite players, Julian Edelman, took a hit. And it was a really big hit, and you could tell from watching him that he didn't look right, that it could have been a concussion. It might have been. They didn't test him at that point. He got up and just kept playing. And you felt like, wait a minute, am I complicit here? I mean, I want them to win. Yeah. I need him to play. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that's his health, man. How did you feel
about
this?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, again, for listeners, I'm one of the good Patriots fans. But here's the thing. I was watching the Super Bowl. They were down by 10 points. It was the fourth quarter. Julian Edelman was their most reliable receiver in that game, and he's very, very small. He gets whacked a lot. He takes a lot of punishment. And they were driving down the field, and Edelman caught a few passes, and he just got licked at one point. And you could clearly see, at least I could from the TV, that he was just staggered, that he was slow getting up. And I just said to myself, and I don't even think I said this out loud, I said, you know, God, I hope no one saw that. I hope the concussion spotter didn't see that. I hope the referee didn't see that, because we need him. And you know, is it going to hurt anyone if maybe they miss a little bit of sign of brain damage there? I mean, look, I need him to get back up, and I want this team to win, and I don't want to think any more about it, because this is a football game, and it's a key part of the game. He doesn't miss a play, but he was clearly staggered. What we later learned was that the concussion spotter sitting up in the press box was trying frantically to reach the sidelines to stop the game so he could be examined for a concussion. They didn't stop the game. For some reason, either the sidelines ignored him or the message didn't get down there. And so I guess my wishes, and I assume the wishes of a lot of people watching the game who we were either betting on the Patriots or who wanted the Patriots to win, and probably on the Patriots sideline too, were rewarded, because, you know, Julian Edelman actually scored a touchdown. They went ahead. They won the game. And, yeah, there was a little controversy afterwards about whether the concussion protocol was honored. But, look, no harm, no foul, right? But certainly, if I'm being honest with myself and I look back and I think about what my reaction was as I was watching it, is that, sure, you know what? As a fan, you are just as competitive and you are just as prone to denial as anyone else, whether you're on the field or off the field. You know, look, I mean, I don't say this with any great pride, but I also thought it was important to try to lay out and explore what it was like to watch that in retrospect and sort of examine whether, you know, how we are complicit. And as fans, you know, whether we should be, in fact, rooting for a better, maybe more responsible result on the field in the moment, which is more important than winning a football game. But then I'm not related to Julian Edelman either.
Boxing used to be the biggest sport in this country, and it's still around, but it, obviously because of the violence of the game, it's not that popular anymore. Do you think that the NFL is going to stay popular for decades, or do you think it can go down the path of boxing?
Absolutely. I mean, that's you know, certainly a doomsday prediction, and there are people like, you know, Malcolm Gladwell is probably the most prominent who has said that he doesn't think football will be remotely what it is today in 20 years or so. I mean, look, I mean, I'm not one of these doomsayers who thinks that, like, the death of the sport is imminent, but I think it's certainly, you know, naive to think that it's going to look exactly the same in 25 years, that the numbers will be as big, that the game will be as entertaining, that there won't be, you know, major challenges that the people who run it are not, you know, are going to have to face. And look, one of the takeaways from Big Game is that the game is what's great, and it's actually better and will probably endure in spite of a lot of the people who run and own the game, because I have not seen a level of leadership that impresses me as a great sort of set of great innovators or corporate thinkers or creative thinkers or really a group of people who are attuned to where the culture is going. Having said that, they have a great product to sell, and I think that people at this moment at least love it, and they are going to continue to. So I guess the future, I guess we'll see. But As of now, I think, you know, the machine is humming, and I wanted to give people a snapshot of what it looks like inside.
That was reporter and author Mark Leibovich talking about the issues of concussions and CTEs in the future of the NFL. He's going to be at the Miami Book Fair Saturday at 4 o'clock in Building 3. Well, staying on the issue of concussions, I want to turn over now to a local story. I want to introduce you to Diana Brett. She's a South Florida mother whose son lived for football. Daniel Brett started playing the game in Pop Warner leagues and one day dreamed of playing at the University of Miami. But something happened on the very first day of high school practice. He suffered a concussion. The Brett family then entered into a long journey of meeting with doctors to find out how they can help their son, whose cognitive health was deteriorating right before their eyes. Diana learned eventually that her son Daniel may have suffered from more than a dozen concussions in his years playing youth football, but he had never said anything about it. Eventually, Daniel couldn't take the pain anymore, and on one fateful day, he took his life. A warning, this story may have some content that is disturbing to other listeners. It was his freshman year, 2009. And he's at practice, and he takes a hit, tells his coach, I can't see. Then you get a call eventually that day, right?
Actually, I called him. I was on my way home from work. I was going by the school, so if he needed a ride home, I was there to pick him up. But when he answered the phone, he said, actually, I'm glad you're coming in. You need to talk to coach. It's like, what happened? Are you okay? He says, yeah, just come on in. And that was it until I saw him.
And then what did you see? What was going on with him?
Went into the school, and he was there with his coaches, and he did not look right. He looked frazzled. He looked red. He looked tired, sweaty. He was squinting. And I immediately asked what happened. The coach said basically he got hit, and he got a concussion, and he needs to stay out. And I'm looking at Daniel like, what happened? He says, I couldn't see anymore. I was done, pretty much.
And then he never played again after that.
No, that was his first day of high school, first day as a JV player, and the last time he ever played football.
He started getting treatment how soon after that? I mean, what did you do? Where did you go?
The next day. That night it was getting late. We went home, called, I believe, the doctor, and they said, if he's okay, go ahead and bring him in tomorrow. So we brought him to the doctor, and that was the first of a whole bunch of doctors that Daniel saw over the next 19 to 20 months. And the opportunity to be able to help him at this point in time, what do you do about a, quote, concussion, was out there. Don't let him fall asleep, you know, make sure, can he follow your finger? It was very routine. It was nothing sophisticated. One of the first things that we did also was get him an MRI to make sure there's no brain bleeds or anything like that. And on that note, all of the different tests that we did have, that we did give him, and he had an enormous amount of tests. None of them show concussions, and that's very important. You might have an MRI, an MRA, and there's a whole list of other ones, but they don't show it's a concussion.
Yeah, I mean, all these doctors that he's going to, and they're putting him on different medications, it seemed like nobody had an answer. Nobody had anything.
No. There is post-concussion syndrome, PCS, and that was the general terminology that they used. Daniel got a concussion, and now it's afterwards, and he has to take it easy. He shouldn't be doing sports. He needs to be watched, and so forth. They put him on Topamax. It was something to alleviate his headaches and his pain, which were augmenting. His restlessness, his lack of sleep or too much sleep, it was everything throughout the next year plus started augmenting. Things started getting to extreme.
When and how did you find Dr. Hotz at the University of Miami?
Out of desperation, on a day off from work, because I have a kid who's hurting. And as a result, his dad's hurting, his sister's hurting, I'm hurting because we cannot help him. And Daniel's behavior was getting more and more aggravated. And so I took a day off of work, and I'll never forget it, sitting at the computer just trying to find something else. I was game to try anything. And I mean, I'd literally looked at sites all over the world like, okay, this has happened to big old pro NFL players, but what about kids? And it's ironic. I'm searching online, and this is 2011. I believe it was January, February. And I happen by chance to come into a newspaper article and from the Miami Herald. And it was about a wonderful young man named David Goldstein. David Goldstein was a soccer player in Dade County. And he had suffered some terrible hits to the head. And again, when I say hits to the head, doesn't mean full-blown concussion, carried, knocked out and carried off. It's a more subconcussive hits to the head on a continuous basis. And he started experiencing a lot of issues that are common with us. By chance, by luck, by fortune, he found Dr. Jillian Hotz at the University of Miami. So picture my surprise. I'm reading a newspaper article, and the people that would be my next step for help for him are University of Miami after all that. Cold called Dr. Hotz at that moment. You always wait 2 to 3 weeks for an appointment. You've got, what's your insurance? What's your this? What's your that? Somebody answered the phone at the University of Miami Concussion Clinic, and I explained, I said, hi, this is who I am, and got a question for you guys. She goes, hang on, whoever this person was, she goes, hang on a second. I said, okay, I'm thinking, here I go, they're going to talk about scheduling and what my insurance is, and a voice got on the phone. This is Dr. Jillian Hotz, can I help you? I almost fell off my chair. It's like, and by now I had read the work that she'd done, not just with David Goldstein, but with others.
She saw you soon, very quickly.
I explained Daniel's story, and she says, you need to come in. Very determined, and no hesitation, no question about anything else. And I'm thinking, okay, whenever you are, I'm there. She goes, can you come in Monday? And this was, I think, a Friday. I'm like, absolutely.
You started to see some improvement with Dr. Hotz's help.
Dr. Hotz is the first doctor who saw Daniel in a different light. Again, it wasn't the blood pressure cuff, the normal tests that every doctor went through. They put him through what I call the Gumby tests, where they do a lot of different mobility tests that test your reflexes and things that should be natural. And Daniel's father and I were watching this as it happened, and it was pretty amazing. Within, you know, that hour, we were being explained how it looked, how Daniel was injured. That a concussion isn't simply just a hit to the head. You're actually doing injury to your brain. And that's the day that I started realizing that the words concussion and brain injury are actually one and the same.
You started to see improvement, but, I mean, eventually, and I wanted to move forward to, it was 2011 when he took his life. What was happening just before that? What was going on with him? Did he go backwards again?
Well, what happened with Daniel was in early of 2011, again, his behaviors were changing, they were getting more erratic, his frustration was there, and it was a continuum. When we found Dr. Hotz, again, this is a kid that's extremely reluctant to see doctors now and take new medication because nothing had been helping, but he gave Dr. Hotz a chance, and she took him off a lot of medicines that he shouldn't have been on for his age and his symptoms, and put him on good medication. And we were there every week, and she was working with him directly. And we finally saw, as I say, some light in Daniel's eyes. And it was fleeting sometimes, because he still had brain injuries in 3 different areas of his head. He started progressing a little bit. When you have a concussion in these certain areas of the brain are damaged, you have a lot of impulse control issues. Judgment values are always not there. Daniel always was a daredevil himself, which did not help him. But at the same point in time, he was very emotional. The opportunity for him to go through an extreme emotion with a personal situation of his caused him to have a very bad relapse, and he was taken to the hospital, and we took care of him. He came home, and unfortunately, within the next 2 to 3 days, he found himself in what I call the perfect storm. Alcohol, I have to say it because full disclosure, was involved. Alcohol was detrimental to the medications also that he was on. If his value judgment was bad before, it's now extremely bad. And he found himself in a situation where he had access to alcohol and guns. And his emotional state had him take that leap. This is hard to say and it's hard to hear, but it's true. We did take Daniel not only to physicians, very well-intentioned physicians, I have to say that, because they thought they were doing the right thing. The fact that the science today, 7 years later, is so much more advanced, I can only say thank you, God, for the next person. But at the time, it wasn't. Moving forward, when he found himself in that situation, also in a total emotional turmoil, he took that leap.
Right after his death, you wanted to get his brain to some researchers in Boston.
Yes.
And they didn't find CTE, which is the NFL players, the chronic traumatic encephalopathy, but they said there was damage. There was a lot of damage.
A lot of damage. And the now known as the Concussion Legacy Foundation I actually called them before I found University of Miami, and I have to give them a lot of credit for giving me hope. They explained what this was about. They had research that a normal person wouldn't know to go to understand what's happening with their child. So if anything, they educated me. And there's some wonderful people there, but unfortunately, you cannot diagnose CTE without an autopsy. And I had a beautiful 16-and-a-half-year-old boy that was going through the same things that Dave Durson, for example, went through in January, I believe, of 2011, because that's how I found out about them. Dave Durson took his life, and he was somebody that was found to have CTE, and they had a story about him as I'm doing all my searching. And I read that, and I was like, oh, my goodness, there's a parallel here. So when I reached out to them before Dr. Hotz, they were very helpful, but they couldn't do anything for me at the time.
Diana, I am sorry for your loss, but I do appreciate you sharing this story, and I hope somebody hears it and they think about the conversations they need to have with their kids.
Thank you. I appreciate the time and the opportunity. Thanks.
Again, Diana Brett sharing her story of how multiple concussions caused a great deal of pain for her son Daniel, who eventually committed suicide. And if you want to know more about concussions and about treatment, go to our Facebook page. We have a story there about Dr. Jillian Hotz at the University of Miami Health System Concussion Program. Well, that's the program for this Thursday, November 15th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.